Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And good evening. Tonight, our special guest is actually my brother, Steve Nato. He's the large carnivore manager for the Idaho Fish and Game Department. And he's he specializes in bears and wolves. Actually, that department kind of does that.
He was recently invited to go and speak at a conference in South Korea, and he's going to speak to us tonight about that. He actually spoke to us live last night on our FM show, Q103, the LA Steel Show out of Lakeville, Connecticut, and we recorded that interview to bring it to you this evening, so we'll put that on after some news.
Yeah, so... Hang on 1 second here, and I'll just see what kind of new news there is.
So,
you want to read about this? Bombshell UN documents outline plan to use climate gate crooks and Enron around national sovereignty.
Shocking newly uncovered UN strategy documents reveal how elitists are recruiting members of academia from all over the globe in an effort to hide the Enron around national sovereignty that their agenda represents, emphasizing how the ClimateGate crooks, who were recently caught manipulating scientific data in order to hide the decline in global warming, are working with the United Nations in the pursuit of world government justified by the global warming fraud that they are helping to perpetrate. And that article, there's a little more in that article, so we'll read a little more. That was just kind of like a
little teaser. And one of the planning papers entitled The UNEP That We Want was produced by a specially selected group of influential environmental bureaucrats and delivered to the UNEP Executive Director, Hakeem Steiner.
The United Nations Environment Program is the regulatory body that established the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The politicized organization that has attempted to slam the lid shut on global warming skepticism by claiming it is the supreme authority, despite the fact that scientists used by the IPCC were caught manipulating data and conspiring to hide evidence of global cooling during the ClimateGate scandal.
The IPCC has attempted to deny the gravitas of ClimateGate by claiming that it has no bearing on their conclusions about global warming, despite the fact that the scientists at the University of East Anglia used intimidation and academic witch hunts to ensure that data they didn't agree with politically was blocked from appearing in the IPCC's fourth assessment report, which was published in 2007.
Participants who contributed to the first UNEP document included Janos Pastor, currently head of the team pushing UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's unprecedented Seal the Deal lobbying campaign to pressure UN member governments into signing a new environmental agreement at Copenhagen. Dominic Waré, currently head of the environmental initiatives at the World Economic Forum, and Maria Ivanova, Director of Global Economic Governance Project at the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy. The first document is very similar to the second UNEP paper entitled Proposed Medium-Term Strategy 2010 through 2013. The documents outline a program of implementing a global system of governance based around environmental regulations and laws, stressing the agenda for the evolutionary nature of strengthening international environmental governance.
The aim of elevating UNEP's influence to a position where it dictates rules to nation states, rather than nation states being the supervisors of UNEP, as is currently the case, is advocated. The documents discuss recruiting academia to further the power of UNEP, noteworthy in light of a recent ClimateGate scandals where scientists at major universities were caught hiding evidence of global cooling. As the Swiss paper puts it, UNEP should pioneer a new style of work. This requires going beyond a narrow interpretation of UNEP's stakeholders as compromising its member states. or even the world's governments, and recruiting a far wider community of support in civil society, the academic world, and the private sector. At the same time, the paper warns that these groups need to be harnessed to the UNEP mission without appearing to make an end run around the members' governments, summarizes Fox News' George Russell.
This passage is fairly damning. As the UN, This passage is fairly damning, as the UN is all but admitting that the program does represent an end run around member governments, and they have to do their best to hide the fact that academics should be harnessed to the UNEP mission and not harnessed to producing unbiased scientific data about global warming also reveals how the climate change issue has been hijacked to serve the requirements of the global elite hell-bent on world government. The first document also calls for an environmental Bretton Woods for the 21st century, where the environmental agenda is inextricably linked with the economic, and the UN's role is to have command over the economic over the economies of national governments.
The goals included in the four-year strategy paper include efforts at local, national, and global levels to raise sufficient finance to meet environmental challenges, including climate change, which translates as using the problem of global warming as raise money for the operations of the global government structure, which is being called for in the planning papers. The goals enshrined in the documents, a counterpart to the globally binding agreement the UN is seeking to achieve in Copenhagen next month, are certain to remain a UNEP rally cry long after the Copenhagen meeting is over. And while the other brainstorming ideas that went into the new four-year strategy, not to mention the strategy itself, go into effect, writes Russell.
This document represents yet another smoking gun, proving that the climate cult movement is all about expanding the power of a dictatorial, unelected global government, diluting powers of nation states, seizing control of the global economy, eviscerating the middle class with a raft of new regulations and laws, and shutting down industry with possible CO2 reduction mandates, while erecting environmentalism, which is really a thin veil for global fascism, as a new universal religion. This has nothing to do with saving the Earth, and as the Climategate scandal has illustrated, nothing to do with real science, but everything to do with a relatively small clique of globalists running roughshod over humanity itself in pursuit of the Malthusian control freak agenda.
Boom. That was good. That was a good article. What do you think?
Yep, that's very similar to one we read last night.
That was by InfoWars.
Now Paul Joseph Watson.
Yeah, but a good one still.
Yeah. And let's see what else we...
Read that one?
Yeah.
Illuminati use magic against us?
Yeah, the Illuminati use magic against us. The Illuminati and their minions enjoy the certain knowledge that the spiritual realm not only exists and at all times interpenetrates our phenomenal world. They also know how to manipulate elements of these spiritual dimensions to make things occur at a given place and time according to their wishes. On the more mundane level, they know how, through the manipulation of words, sound, and symbols, to change people and the flow of events of the world in which we all move. If magic can be defined as the art of science causing change in our world to occur in conformity with will, then the Illuminati, who know with a certainty that the spiritual realm exists as part of our ordinary sensory reality, have also learned how to bend, shape, and manipulate that reality and the people within it to effect change which will benefit them. Let's see what more that has.
Curious, sir.
There's some more to this article. They may do this through elaborate ritual or simply imposing their will upon another through the strength of their thoughts. However, it is often desirable and sometimes even necessary to acquire the actual physical excreta of a person they wish to control. Therefore, strands of hair, one's fingernail clippings, or a jot of blood will provide the physical spiritual link between the one they wish to influence and the controller. In the case of the late Philip John Jones, the Illuminati may well have sent an agent or agents to gather the physical linkage they needed. For surely, as in an insulated electrical wire will deliver its current to whatever is tethered at the other end, the direct physical link to the subject of their manipulation and attack will provide the most direct path for their influence. Aware of his vulnerabilities, they used a damsel in distress to gain access to his personal space, and his physical cast-offs, hair, nails, etc., found in his bathroom, in order to directly manipulate his health. And more than likely, to ensure the probability of their success, a mixture of homemade vitamins compounded by his inamorata of the moment were added to seal his fate. As we sleepwalk through our daily lives, most of us really think how the spiritual world always interpenetrates our own. We really question what may be happening in the world of manifestation, the spiritual world, where what is to become real begins to form and take shape before it actually appears in our phenomenal world of physical reality. We think of time as linear. We think of people and events as isolated. And yet quantum theory has proven that all things and all people and all events are interconnected. This perpetual interconnection of all people and events in the continuum of time provide the Illuminati with the certainty that future events can be manipulated by the manipulation of signs, symbols, words, music, rituals, and spells. This is magic.
In the spiritual realm, the realm where good and evil coexist as readily as they do in the typically mundane sphere of our five senses, those with wisdom of such things know that nothing happens by accident, nothing happens by chance, and there is a design and purpose to everything, whether or not our intellect can perceive it, and that all things are interconnected in both space and time, both from the past through the present to the future. And it is in that future, the pliable plastic world of becoming, the world of manifestation, hardening into the reality of direct sensory experience, which can be changed and bent and shaped by those adroit at using the living symbols of these arcane arts to tamper with the destinies of man, of men, and of mankind as they see wish. None of the Illuminati's manipulations enjoy a foregone conclusion of success. They only become successful because they brook no strong, knowledgeable resistance in our world to their operations on the plane of manifestation, which interlock with our plane of physical reality. And you must understand that they're operating on two worlds. And if you want a closer look at what I wrote an article today, a couple of days ago, about the fourth dimension. I think you might want to look at that because it touches on all of this and explains where that fourth dimension is.
It is not simply the ignorance of the laws of the world of the spirit, which have nothing to do with good or evil, since both reside in the spiritual realm as easily as they do in our sensory world, which preclude us from challenging the Illuminati at their own game. It is the fact that our feeble, rational mind, which bears as much relationship to full-spectrum reality as our puny egos bear to the power and capacity of our total mind, cannot bear to admit that it does not have all the answers or all the knowledge of all things in heaven and earth. And it is from this arrogance of rational ego that the Illuminati will continue to be able to manipulate those who refuse to grasp and admit that their knowledge and use of the laws of the realm of the spirit will continue to provide them with an unassailable advantage until we, too, fine-tune our first spiritual perceptions and learn to fight back and reverse the forces that have unleashed upon us to cause them the havoc they wish to inflict upon our world. Until that time, when we learn to become spiritual warriors for truth and learn the operational laws of the spiritual world, until we admit that the spiritual world is an eternal part of our normal waking reality, we will continue to be blinded to the powers and abilities the Illuminati wield against an ignorant populace, separated from their heritage of spiritual divinity and power. I was just looking to see who this article was by.
It was by L.C. Vincent.
Hmm.
It was written for the... you can check out. You can check out his.
For henrymackow.com.
Yeah, henrymackow.com is the site that we're on. So we just got off of. I can refer you to David Icke's site, which is davidicke.com.
Mm.
And Obama's Christian grandmother has arrived in Mecca for the Hajj.
Mm.
During the 2008 presidential campaign, there were rumors Barack Obama was a Muslim. Obama denied these rumors and claimed he is a Christian. He did attend a Chicago church led by the radical Reverend Wright for 20 years. There was a strong attempt to debunk the Obama is a Muslim rumor. And during this time period, AP ran a story supporting Obama's claim to be a Christian and identifying his paternal mother as a Christian.
But paternal grandmother.
Grandmother as a, I'm sorry, paternal grandmother as a Christian. Let's see. Obama's father.
Grandfather
converted to Islam from Roman Catholicism and taken the name Hussein. Sarah Obama said, but his children had inherited only the name, not the religion. Each person should be able to choose how they worship, she said. In the world of today, children have different religions from their parents. She said she, too, is a Christian. And now we learn Obama's Christian grandmother has arrived in Saudi Arabia for the Hajj. The Hajj is a holy pilgrimage to Mecca. All Muslims are required to make, and is one of the five pillars of Islam. Well, Mecca, November 25th, the grandmother of...
U.S. President.
Yeah, and from Mecca, right? The grandmother of U.S. President Barack Obama has arrived in Saudi Arabia for the Hajj, Islamic pilgrimage to the holy sites of Mecca and Medina, a Saudi daily said on Wednesday. And Sarah Obama, 87, is being accompanied by a nephew and Obama's cousin, Omran. On Wednesday, Sarah Obama was in the Valley of Mina and an African delegation, according to Saudi daily Okaz.
Mm.
Interesting, no?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, another surprise by
why would a Christian make the pilgrimage
make the Muslim
for the Hajj?
Yeah, doesn't make much sense.
That doesn't make any sense.
Let's see, Daily Express, climate change fraud, eviction Palestinians sleep on the streets outside their homes.
That's so sad.
That's 3 minutes. You think we should play that?
Yeah.
This is a YouTube video about evicted Palestinians sleep on the streets outside their homes after they've been kicked out by the damned Israelis. It's about 3 minutes.
Palestinian home now occupied by Jewish settlers. Israeli police invaded this house in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood at dawn on Sunday. The Hanun family, who'd lived there for decades, were thrown out onto the street.
We are living on the street, as you see, all the day and the night here. We are sleeping here and we have mattresses and blankets. I said that before, if they kick us out, we will be homeless. We don't have any place to go.
Israeli police are now protecting the settlers, right-wing Jews who are on a mission to expel Palestinians from the whole of occupied East Jerusalem.
How do you feel about stealing this house from its rightful owners?
Excuse me, please know it. Please know it. Come, okay?
Why,
thank you.
Thank
you, please.
Just down the road, settlers have taken over another Palestinian house. We try to go and visit the Rawi family, who've also been homeless since Sunday. But we find our way blocked by more Israeli police.
This is a public street, yeah? This is a street. It's a public right of way.
This place, this special place, blocked.
Why is it special?
Well, it's special.
So you can see, not only are they evicting Palestinians from houses, they're also closing streets in East Jerusalem, setting up roadblocks, preventing people from moving around freely. In this way, the Israeli authorities are showing that they hold international law in complete contempt. Sitting in solidarity with her neighbours is Kamel. The Israelis kicked her out of her home last November. It's a story of dispossession that keeps repeating. Kamel takes me to a street in West Jerusalem, the Israeli side of the city. Her family owned a house here before the Arab-Israeli War of 1948. It was demolished long ago. Israeli homes stand here now.
I tell Israel, this is my property in West Jerusalem. Give it back to me. My father also owned a shop in the city center. Give us back our property that was confiscated in 1948.
But there's no hope of that. Israel operates double standards. In property claims, as in every aspect of life, there is one rule for Jews and another for Palestinians.
The Nazis did the same thing for Jews that the Jews are doing now.
Jews who lived here, or even who rented here before 48, can come back and say, well, this is our property. So Jews can come back and take these properties. Palestinians cannot go back and take the more massive properties that they were deprived of in West Jerusalem and in Israel itself.
Evening falls in Sheikh Jarrah, and the Hanoun family is settling down for another uncomfortable night on the street. This is the image that Israel now presents to the world, a country that claims to be democratic, yet oppresses the weakest members of society. Jackie Rowland, Al Jazeera, in occupied East Jerusalem.
Well, there you go, folks. That's what's happening in Jerusalem right now. They're kicking out the Palestinians out of their own homes. Onto the streets and taking over their houses without any payment. They're just throwing them out on the street. And it's unbelievable. There's no law enforcement.
There's only large
Israeli law enforcement.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, there's
expand that country illegally and to steal people's property and their homes, and their life, and their jobs, everything.
It's a
Zionist conspiracy.
And it's criminal. It's absolutely criminal. Why it's allowed to continue is beyond me. Beyond me. And anyway, milking the last bloody nickels from enduring lies. Obama rhymes with Osama. Is going to send some tens of thousands of new zombies into Afghanistan to protect Bush Sr.'s opium crops, to secure necessary transit lines and resources for that per percentage of the world that uses far more than it needs to live at the higher standards that those they are stealing from. He's also going to Copenhagen to show for a major criminal enterprise whose intention is yet another unbearable tax upon the backs of humanity, as well as to secure the financing to operate a worldwide fascist governing body. I like the tone of this. I'll just read a few things here if there's any more. I don't know what happened there. But this guy is an interesting writer.
We can't find the rest of that article.
Yeah, the rest of that article just goes to Reflections in a Petri Dish. I want to check that one out. And let's see. I think that's about it. I'd like to get to the... The Gore family linked to corporate oil man. Let's see.
The vice president is often presented as a wooden and somewhat simple-minded clone of Mr. Clinton. In fact, his political background, they're talking about Al Gore, is far more interesting and complex. His political career developed out of that of his father, Senator Al Gore of Tennessee, who gave up his position in 1971 to become head of the coal division of Hammers Oil Company, Occidental Petroleum. His annual salary was $500,000 a year. Let's see what else. It's a very corrupt family. Like Dodd, he's a
crook.
Father was a crook, and he's a crook.
Yeah, it just continues down.
Legalized crookery, though. You know, they're politicians. Just legalized crook. You think the mafia was bad?
Let's see. Early in the U.S. presidential campaign, Vice President Al Gore attempted to follow President Clinton at the White House, was almost capsized by allegations that he had turned a blind eye to corruption in Russia, despite frequent contact with that country's leaders. Early in the U.S. presidential campaign, Vice President Al Gore's attempt to follow President Clinton at the White House was almost capsized.
Well, that's a repeat. The Vice President was vulnerable because between 1993 and 1998, he'd taken a leading role in formulating U.S. policy towards Russia as chairman of a joint commission on relations between the countries. The former Russian Prime Minister Viktor Chermodurin was joint chairman. Mr. Gore had boosted the commission as evidence that he was a serious international statesman and more than a decorative figure in the Clinton White House. The claim blew up in his face last year when critics asked why, if he knew so much about Russia, he only learned from newspapers about the scandal of the laundering of $10 billion in Russian money through the Bank of New York.
I should say, too, that this article through the Independent is a reprint from May 21st, 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I just want people to reference that. This happened in 2000, but that gives you a history of Gore.
Let's see, we missed you.
Early 1950. Yeah.
No, you just jumped over.
No, I didn't.
Yes, you did.
It's right here. No, it's like down. No, let that go. Problem with this site is you have to click it.
Oh, right here. Criticism of the vice president of the Chermodurin Gore Commission missed the real target, says sources in Moscow. He was telling the truth when he said he knew a great deal about Russia. He could not publicly explain, however, that his knowledge stemmed from the extraordinary relationship between his father, Senator Al Gore Sr., and Armin Hammer, the American multimillionaire, who after meeting Lenin became the Soviet Union's first foreign investor in 1921.
Hammer also served, according to Secret Service documents, Secret Soviet documents, since released as the conduit for laundering money, Soviet intelligence operations, communist parties abroad. That was pretty well known. That's been out. We've done that for quite a few years, but
the American press missed the point of the Gore-Chermodian scandal. A diplomat in Moscow said last week, Gore had access to the Soviet and then the Russian leadership long before he met Chermodian because of his father's links to Hammer and Hammer's high-level contacts in the Soviet Union. The vice president is often presented as a wooden and somewhat simple-minded clone of Mr. Clinton. In fact, his political background is far more interesting and complex. His political career developed out of that of his father, Senator Al Gore, Sr. of Tennessee, who gave up his position in 1971 to become the head of the coal division of Hammer's oil company, Occidental Petroleum. His annual salary was $500,000. That's a lot of money in 1971.
Yeah, like $5 million today.
The link between Hammer and Al Gore, Sr. was intimate and went back many years to when he was a congressman from Tennessee. Hammer once said, according to a U.S. source, that he had Gore in his back pocket.
I want to get to the interview.
As
early as 1950, according to Edward J. Epstein's autobiography of Hammer, he made Congressman Gore his partner in a profitable cattle breeding business. Hammer needed political protection. J. Edgar Hoover, even before he became head of the FBI, had been tracking him as a possible Soviet agent. For once, Hoover was right, though that only became clear in 1996 when the Russian government released secret archives to Mr. Epstein, and Congress Al Gore Sr. helped to keep the FBI off Hammer's back. And Hammer, who died in 1990, was notorious for advancing his business interests by systematic bribery of politicians and government officials. And he won an important oil concession for Occidental in Libya in 67 by paying a large bribe.
Bribe than anybody else.
Senator Gore Sr. stood beside him on the podium at the Oilfield Opera opening ceremony the following year. So you know, oil man Gore is a fraud, just like his old man's a fraud, and fraud.
This article goes on quite a bit.
Article.
It's a long article, but it gives you the gist of things anyway.
I'm going to back out of this bad boy here and go right to our show.
We're going to bring you the interview with Steve Nato talking about his trip to Korea.
Yeah.
South Korea, actually, where he spoke at a symposium, I guess, people from all over the world who are interested in black bears and their population.
Right.
I think you'll find this interesting.
And also, I have we're going to have Lila reads one a really interesting article about the French military taking over vaccination places there. So
That comes first.
I thought it was a very good article.
And then followed by Theodore.
So I hope you enjoy this.
Well, is on the French army, it's to be used in swine flu vaccine centers. Kind of scary. The French Army's medical corps is to help carry out vaccination in the country's 1,080 vaccine centers, according to an announcement by the French Ministry of Interior today. That was Saturday. The Army is being called in along with doctors and other healthcare personnel to operate the controversial centers and administer the untested swine flu jab in spite of, or because of, evidence of low voluntary uptake of the jab among the population. According to French government figures, only about 300,000 people have taken the jab so far, in spite of extreme pressure from the Ministry of Health and daily media hype about the alleged dangers of the swine flu. A secret French government document leaked in August revealed plans by the health minister, Roselyne Bachelet, to vaccinate the entire population between the end of September and January in the specially established centers, many of which have extra security features. Also, secret documents from the Justice Ministry showed that the plans were in place to allow the imprisonment of people for up to 6 months without being charged under the pretext of controlling pandemic emergencies. This week, French police intervened to shut down a school by force in spite of protests by the local mayor and school director, who said there was no evidence of a swine flu pandemic in their school. 400 schools in France have been shut in the past couple of weeks as the government propagates the myth of a country under siege from the swine flu. The decision to draft in the highly controversial French Medical Corps, which has played a key role in guarding and distributing the flying swine flu jabs, will raise fears in France that the government is using the pandemic as an excuse to hollow out civic rights and that the move to a compulsory vaccination of the population is in the cards. So, sounds like France is being a little heavy-handed about the swine flu and inoculating its population. So, do we have our guest?
Yes, we do. We have Steve Nadeau on the line. Hello, Steve. How are you?
Good. Leo, how are you?
Very good.
Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And welcome back. You were in South Korea, I understand.
Yeah, I got back, I guess it's been 2 weeks now. Been back.
So, your trip over there was to talk about bears, and they are threatened species in South Korea. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, the Asiatic black bear, although fairly well distributed across Asia, you know, the Korean Peninsula, through the Korean War and through, you know, basically population over the last 1,000 years or so, and the development over the last 50 particularly has really isolated black bear populations. The Asiatic black bear populations to a few isolated tracts, mostly their national park system.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't very many undeveloped lands left in South Korea.
Now, this might seem like a dumb question, but, you know, being an American and not having traveled to Asia, what is the size of South Korea? What kind of land mass are we talking about?
Well, it took us about 5 hours to drive from Seoul, which is in the north part of the country, to the national park, Jirasan National Park, in the south end of the country. So, I would say it's roughly equivalent to probably driving from northern part of Maine to the southern part of Maine.
Oh, okay.
So basically, yeah.
So that's not a very large country.
Well, no, that's South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's a demilitarized zone between North and South Korea, and
then you have North Korea, of course.
Yeah, and of course, there's 45 million people in South Korea. The city of Seoul has about 10.5 million people. people, and rather than building out, they built up in Korea. Although they're historical Eastern culture, they're very modern and westernized in a lot of ways. But capitalism in Korea or South Korea has done remarkable things for their country.
Mm-hmm.
Very well off and actually quite rich. We didn't see very much poverty at all compared to most of our travels. And just a lot of glitz and glamour. South Korea and Seoul is quite a metropolitan cosmo center of sorts, and a lot of things going on there.
Yeah.
Old mixed with the new.
Yeah. The park that you went to, you said that is that the only national park they have there, or?
Oh, they've got a series of parks. I'm trying to remember how many. It was 10 or 15 parks. Jirasan, which is the park that the conference was at, is in the southern part of the state, or the country, is the largest national park, and it's about 500 square kilometers in size, and it's mostly mountainous, and it's the Korea has a lot of hardwood forests, similar to, I would say, similar to New England, in a lot of ways. And we've got some, of course, some pines, some Japanese pines, and Asian pines of sorts. But they have the beech trees and the oak trees, and a lot of mass-producing trees, a lot of nuts there, which provide quite a food source for bears and other wildlife, such as the wild boar. Creates quite a problem for the farmers. The other interesting thing about the national parks in Korea is they're unlike the U.S. parks. In Korea, they establish these parks long after the people live there, so they have lots of inholdings, farms, and cattle, and beehive apiaries. They develop maple syrup, or they gather maple syrup out of the national parks. So when we were there, they took us on tour, and there were tubes. This was in the fall, in November, and there were tubes at about my height, about six foot four or so, that I had to duck to get under. These rubber tubes piping maple syrup in the spring from trees. This whole system of maple syrup collection. And we were walking down from bee apiary, where they were raising honey. So there's a lot of attractants for bears, and consequently a lot of potential conflicts with
bears. Is this where they want to develop the bear population in this particular park?
Right, Jirasan is one of the, because it's the biggest park, they wanted to develop a population of over 50 black bears. Right now there are currently 15, or I guess 17 bears, they think, are in the park, of which 5 are wild, and the rest were introduced from North Korea, from China, from Japan, and Russia.
So how are those 15 doing? Are they reproducing?
Well, they have a very high mortality rate. There were two reproductions, or two females had cubs, of which only one cub survived out of all of them. And for the most part, they have real high mortality. Now, that's to be expected in any reintroduced population. You're going to expect fairly high initial mortality until the population gets established. But Jirasan and their other national parks have this whole issue with conflicts with people that they have to deal with. One of the big things is the more direct mortality to the bears is the Russian boar comes in and causes a great deal of problems with the farms, tearing up the agricultural fields, and so they set these neck snares to capture the boar, and of course they incidentally capture the black bear. They don't have as many problems with the bears as they do with boars, however, when they're trying to catch the boars, which are illegally, you're not allowed to do any hunting or trapping within the park. It's the only thing you're not allowed to do, basically, within the park. But they do, and within the last, they started to recover the bear population in 2002. They set this national agenda to recover the Asiatic black bear.
I was curious because they don't seem to be endangered in other areas like I was.
Oh, they're fairly widespread.
Yeah.
Several thousand of them exist.
Russia and Japan and other.
Yeah, right. There are fairly good densities in Japan. In some areas, there are slightly different subspecies.
Yeah.
So they have to be very. I think they figured something in the vicinity of 14 different subspecies of Asiatic black bear.
Wow, really? Yeah.
These are genetically slightly different, and so they have to be very careful about which bears they're introducing. They're raising them in captivity, which is the other unique thing about this recovery program.
Hmm.
They're actually reintroducing bears that have been raised in captivity. So you're looking at
something quite different
than what, for instance, we do in the U.S. with our grizzly bear populations, where we're recovering bears by moving, you know, wild sub-adult bears from another part of the country.
Wow. Do you mate them in captivity, or do you?
Yeah, they raise. They actually. What they've done is they've captured cubs from Russia and North Korea and Japan recently, and these cubs have been orphaned from the adults. The female was killed for one reason or another, and they had these cubs, and then they bring them into this recovery facility, which they showed us. And how they would raise these cubs to, you know, adequate size, which would be, you know.
Now they got these from South Korea. Got these, right?
South Korea, right? Korea,
yeah,
got the bears
cubs,
from
yeah.
these other countries, and would raise them in their South Korean facilities, and then bring them out to the release site, what they call, or what we call, a soft release site, which is a fenced-in area where they put the bears into as they become somewhat familiar with their surroundings in the wild. They give them natural foods there and let them learn the natural foods that they'll be rooting for or looking for. And then they also try to train them, aversively condition them to stay away from beehives and those sorts of things.
How much of an area do they need, like, for each bear? You know, like three.
Well, a real high density of bears would be one per one or two square kilometers, which would be, you know, so somewhat similar to black bear densities, for instance, in Maine or something like that.
Yeah.
Very high. They can get pretty high densities, assuming that you have, you know, adequate food and you're not killing them.
Yeah. Are they the same size as our black bears, or are they?
They're pretty close to the same size. The Asiatic black bear is. You've probably seen pictures, or your listeners have seen pictures. They're the bear. They have a big white blaze over their chest. They have big Mickey Mouse ears. A little bit more long-legged than seemingly our black bears. But one of the unique things about them, which I was totally enthralled with, I'd seen them before in zoos, but never up close like they brought us to these bears. And what was very interesting were how thick their necks are. And they have this real broad face, neck, and shoulders. And as we were standing above them, and on the side of them, one of the questions that I had was, how the heck do you put a radio collar on the neck of this bear? Is bigger than its head, so it would slide right off.
How do they do that? Do they inject one or something like that?
Great difficulty. They have to shave a bunch of the hair off around the neck and snug it up pretty good. But they have very, very thick.
You would think, though, now with that, where they just like they do with animals, or, you know, they give them chips, you know.
The microchips, of course, are, you know, you can put them in and you can identify a bear when it's in hand, but the radio collars are for tracking,
yeah.
Radio tracking,
yeah.
Aerial tracking,
yeah. Tracking,
or satellite tracking bears over large distances are great.
Right. So
what is it they exactly want to accomplish? They want to have a wild bear population?
Right. There are a couple different objectives. One is to recover black bear populations in each of the national parks that are large enough to sustain populations within South Korea, and to connect the parks to the DMZ, or the Demilitarized Zone, to North Korea, where the Demilitarized Zone has been kind of vacant for the last 50 years, and so the wildlife still exists there. It hasn't been developed.
How big an area is that Demilitarized Zone? I mean,
I'm not 100% sure, but I really don't know right now. I can't tell you. I think
probably a large tower,
or something like that.
So there's wildlife in that Demilitarized Zone?
Yeah. Excuse me?
There's wildlife in that demilitarized.
Yeah, correct. There's wildlife, fairly, you know, good populations of wildlife within that strip of land. Mm-hmm. And so they're hoping to, you know, connect to that area, you know, down south through the crest of Korea. I mean, mountainous country. It's quite a lovely country. And you know, they're hoping to connect the parks along the spine of the country and, you know, with the corridor to let the bears roam naturally, which I think is a real good objective, but we have a very difficult time doing it out here in the Mountain West.
Mm-hmm.
U.S., where we do have large expanses, vast expanses of land without people. I mean, they were somewhat amazed that I live here in Idaho, which is, you know, we have 1.5 million people, and it takes, you know, 12 hours to drive from the north part of the state to the south. So it's quite a bit different.
Yeah. So,
now, are there any talks with even with North Korea on?
Yeah, but North Korea is kind of persnickety about these things. And, as you know, there's a lot going on. I have quite a bit of difficulty communicating with North Korea.
Yeah, I understand that.
Wildlife is pretty, you know, it's not a very sensitive issue, but it's an issue, and they have gotten a few bears from North Korea, my understanding. So they're getting some cooperation.
Yeah.
But really not enough, probably.
Probably not enough.
Yeah, you had a good time there, you saw a lot of the country, a lot of people.
They're a very warm culture.
A lot of sightseeing.
Particularly, from what I understand, if you're honorably introduced, which we were as a delegation of Americans and foreign biologists, they asked us, they invited us to South Korea to help them and give them advice on bear recovery. So they treated us very well, like royalty in a lot of ways.
Royalty, yeah.
They catered to us extensively.
So tell me, what is royalty treated like? What is royalty treated?
Very well, I don't know what royalty is treated like.
But you felt like one anyway.
It would be treated.
Yeah, well, from a guy who's coming out of the backwoods of Idaho there, you know, trodden along.
Well,
what is royalty like? Giving you a hotel room?
They took us everywhere. They treated us, you know, to excellent meals.
Yeah.
And,
will they be coming to visit you and to see?
They did come to visit two summers ago.
Oh, they did.
Excuse me, last summer, last spring, they came to Idaho to learn a bit about our bear management activities, and I provided them with a bunch of information, including I gave them a wolf skull, one of our wolves that were killed for depredation purposes, and I gave them a skull as a gift, and when we toured over there, they had that skull on display in one of their museums, their natural history museum.
How about that, huh?
Yeah, that was pretty good.
They didn't give you a bear skull or anything?
No.
I think Steve could have plenty of those.
That's cool. That's really nice. That's nice they did that.
I was going to ask
if they had any wolves there.
No, historically they did, but they've been extirpated since the war.
Oh.
And they've got really interesting wildlife there, really, from, you know, having not paid any attention to what the Korean Peninsula wildlife prior to this trip and studying up a little bit about it. They've got a small deer with canines, actual, you know, fangs. That's extend a few inches. Yeah.
Really? What do they prey on?
You know, I think those are just kind of vestigial.
Oh, really?
Lines, but they, you know, as a matter of fact, we even if you look at 1,000 whitetail skulls from New England, you might find some with a few little canines on them. But these are actually they're present on all of their deer. They've got a little pine marten, which is like a ferret or a weasel in the weasel family.
Mm-hmm.
It's bigger than our North American pine marten, and they actually supposedly run in packs and take down deer.
Wow.
Our pine martens in North America are, you know, solo hunters, and they eat squirrels. Each pine marten in Korea take down deer. But their deer are smaller.
I was going to say, either they're pretty big or the deer are small over there.
But are the pine marten, are they still that size in Korea, or are they bigger?
They're a little bigger than our.
A little bigger.
They're more like a size of a fisher.
Yeah.
That's just some of the unique sorts of things that they're wild with.
Yeah. So what other, like, what kind of, I've never been to either, but what kind of fauna do they have? What kind of, you said it's a lot like here. Like,
the vegetation.
Like New England or wherever it is, a lot of hardwood and all that.
Flora, the vegetation is quite similar. It's hardwood forest. We were there in November. They were changing colors, the tail end of the fall foliage season. A lot of reds and golds and oaks and maples and so forth.
Climate-wise, what was the weather like? I know they get pretty
Very
cold.
Similar to probably your climate in Connecticut.
They get really cold winters.
It's quite cold because there's the ocean climate, it's a peninsula, so you get wind and weather from the ocean, from both sides.
Right.
So it can be quite hot in the summer.
So, like you said, they build everything up rather than out. So, they got a tremendous number of high-rises there?
As far as the eye can see, high-rises, when we were in Seoul, we went to the North Seoul Tower, which gets you up above the city on a mountain in a tower. And as far as you can see, 360 degrees were high-rises. They build up, not out. And the interesting thing is their infrastructure is such that, they depend very much on mass transportation. So there wasn't a whole lot of traffic. Imagine a city of 10.5 million people and no traffic jams.
Wow.
Well, that's kind of a novelty.
Yeah, no kidding.
In New York City,
wasn't any more traffic. We commented on this a few times. There wasn't any more traffic in downtown Seoul during rush hour than there was in Boise, Idaho, a city of...
Holy cow, really,
300,000 people. Yeah, everybody out here, of course, one person per vehicle.
And right.
Have subways and buses. We rode the buses and the subways around the city, and the buses from Seoul to the park. And they, the buses were only half full. Subways weren't, for some reason, nearly as crowded. People walk. People walk everywhere.
Really?
No, they must be in very good shape.
They are. I mean, that was one of the first things we noticed when we got off the plane was how thin everybody was over there.
Huh.
And athletic looking they were, and everybody was walking everywhere and walking.
That's interesting. That's really next to our culture.
Well, yeah. I mean, that was the first thing we noticed when we got off the plane, how large everybody, when we got back into Seattle, how large everybody was.
And not a good large either, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, are you...
Great. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, I said, are you planning any other conferences or any other trips in the near future?
I kind of, as they come up, I address them when they come up. There was one in Taiwan immediately after this one. It was a conflict conference. I almost went to that one, but I had my wife with me and we needed to get back. So.
Yeah. So, no, that was great. You had a good trip.
I just wanted to ask you, of course, this is a political show, so our main focus is politics, but I wanted to ask you if anybody talked to you about American politics or asked you anything about it.
Well, it was interesting because we had, at the conference, we had people from all over the world, biologists from all over the world, and we had... people from United Arab Emirates. We had people from China, Japan, Norway, Sweden.
Are you finding any, are they talking at all about climate changes?
It's being addressed at most of the conferences now in some fashion, climate change and how to address it for the long term, how it will impact bears. Matter of fact, grizzly bears in the West here in Yellowstone were relisted recently. One of the prime reasons that they were delisted temporarily while there was a lawsuit going on, and they were relisted after being almost 2 years delisted. Primary reason being climate change, concerns of climate change. And the judge didn't think that the Fish and Wildlife Service had adequately addressed climate change.
There's this huge controversy now about this. But there isn't really any climate change.
Well, there's always climate change, the controversy is of global warming.
CO2, yeah.
I've been reading some about that too, but there is a climate change, and in some areas it's warming very dramatically, in other areas it's not. The controversy seems to stem from whether or not it's natural cycles or man-made. Most of the scientists agree that it's that it's man-made, but it's very real. If you live in the Northern Hemisphere and are in Alaska and in the Arctic, where the ice now doesn't form until several weeks later, and it's much thinner, and they're now talking about.
But I heard the Antarctic ice shelf is just went 30 miles or extended over 30 miles. All right,
chunks broke off. There's big chunks of ice in and around Australia now, which hasn't happened. So things are changing and shifting, and there'll be controversy about this until we're fried for one reason or another. But
well, 30,000 scientists just sued Al Gore in a class action suit against his global warming, convenient truth.
Inconvenient truth.
One of the things that I recognize recently, we had 200 scientists sign a letter saying that wolves should not be delisted.
Mm-hmm.
That was a political statement, and based on an opinion. There was not one of those scientists was involved with wolves in the West.
Well, these scientists, the 30,000, are all climatologists, all right? And they sued Al Gore, okay, or are in the process of a full suit against him. And
what are they suing him for?
For misinformation, misleading people, and basic fraud.
99% of the politicians.
Oh, yeah. Well, you start with one, right?
Well, he also has backed away from his statements.
No, he did, but not without incredibly investing in green. He's the first green billionaire.
Or will be.
Or will be if this carbon tax goes through. So.
And if it's not true, then he'll be the first, the next billionaire to lose a billion.
hopefully be bye-bye for Gore.
Yeah, maybe so, I would invest, if I was as smart as him, in those things, too. Yeah, as far as what the international politics are, I mean, the people that we talked to were...
Yeah, but would you, the question is here, not that the wise person wouldn't invest in green policies, but would you, the question with Gore is he manipulating the green concepts and manipulating the whole climate change thing
in order to
become a green billionaire?
Well, if you know anything about Al Gore, he's been preaching the global climate change since he was in college when he took that course. He wrote a book called, 20 years ago.
Mm.
And so he's been on this thing when he was wet behind the ears. If he's making money off it, that means he believes in it, that this is where the future should be.
Well, not really. It just means that he's manipulating the science
One view of it.
I mean, this guy owns nuclear power plants. I mean, this guy's been is in the oil company, oil business, and he's advocating nuclear power. All right, it's a frightening. He's a frightening guy, but. It's interesting. I didn't know the scientific community really. It seems to be coming down hard against him right now. Yeah.
Well, I mean, not the entire community. There's.
Well, there's obviously some division in the science community, as there is.
And if you're familiar with a lot of these environmental arguments, which I've been involved in my entire career. Is that if you shop around, you can find whatever science you want.
I think what people have to remember is that most of these things are theories that they're talking about right now. They're not talking about facts. They're talking about theories.
And the way that science works is theories are tested and they're corrected.
Yeah.
And if a theory holds water, like the theory of gravity and the theory of evolution, they're constantly tested. And after thousands and thousands of years, they become, or hundreds of years, they become fact.
Well, actually, did you hear about the release of these emails from these professors and involved with the climate change?
Controversy.
Data.
Yeah.
Okay. All of these emails were hacked. This whole thing was hacked into. And
I read a little bit about that. That there were a couple emails that were taken out of context or something. But
I guess
I'm not a climatologist. I am not a global warm theorist. I know very little about it other than what I read. So if you want to talk about that,
no.
I'll talk to you about wildlife.
He just wanted to see what you you knew about that and where you stood on it.
How it supposedly affects all of these things.
Well, certainly, if you're in the area that's famous, then he has to think about wildlife.
Being, you know, for instance, we have snow melt happening earlier, quicker in the west. And whether it's a short cycle or a long cycle or a change, I mean, we've seen global climatic catastrophes forever. So what people are saying is, well, this is a normal cycle. And, well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's human cause, and that's where the argument is.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not it is, and if we can do something about it, if we don't do anything about it and we're wrong, we're screwed. So that's where the arguments are.
Gotcha. Well, hey, it's been great fun, man, talking to you. And it's always a pleasure having you on. And we can, thanks for being on.
And thanks for talking about
the... Fast again.
Yep. What's,
yeah, it's definitely going to happen again. So have a great time. Say hi to Kara, and
thanks for being with us.
And thanks for calling. Talk to you later.
Take care.
And that was Stephen Nadeau talking to us about the black bear out in South Korea. Actually, they want to increase the population there, and he was over there to help the South Koreans do that.
Yeah. And that was...
And we put him on the spot a little bit about global warming.
Yeah. And
a particular interest of our audience.
Yeah. And Steve happens to be my brother as well, so
I
like to say it after I interview him instead of before I interview him. So it's like, so if I sound a little familiar, yeah, I've known him, you know, he's my brother. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for joining us and wish you the best. And we'll be talking to you next week. And you can join us on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday night
BlogTalkRadio.com,
or just go to the LA Steel Show, lasteelshow.org, and click on Listen Live, and I'll take you right to the show page. So we wish you the best, and
let's sing out. Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling on.
We usually end our show with that, our Tuesday night show every Tuesday night. We always end with Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, our version of it. But I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. I hope you enjoyed the show. And tell your friends and join us tomorrow night when I believe I'll continue reading my possibly. I'm not sure if I'll be continue reading my new book, chapters 8 and 9, I believe. Well, we'll go from there. I was also thinking of possibly starting a new series on Thursday nights, but I'll announce that tomorrow. So please join me tomorrow night right here at 8 o'clock, and have a good evening.